It's Jeff. Welcome to the Meat House. I'm here with my buddy Chris, as usual.
How you doing today?
Doing all right, man. Hanging out with my friend, drinking some mead. It's a good time. Hope you guys at home listening are having a good time as well. Today, you wanted to talk about take a deeper dive into some sanitation methods.
Sanitation and what yeast and how yeast and meat responds to temperature.
Yeah.
A little more information. Also, the meat of the day is something that you had.
Yeah, this is all that is now from Sap House Meadery. Sap House, I've been subscribing to their meat club for an age and a day. This is one of their barrel aging programs. This is a blueberry varietal honey. It's been aged in a brandy barrel for 8 months. It's a 15.6% ABV. The barrel aging program over at Sap House is, I'm just consistently impressed by this stuff. It's always like the flavors, the barrel, what I want to say, the spirits in the barrel, they just play so nicely together. Like, this is an inspired line. I'm always happy to hop open one of these guys. And so just looking at this, it's nice, light.
Medium straw?
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't say dark straw, wouldn't say light straw. It's kind of in the middle there.
Yeah, hold on. I smell the honey.
Get a little honey. Get a little of that brandy character, too. Yeah, a little brandy. Just a little.
But I'm not smelling a whole bunch of I don't smell the blueberry.
Well, and it's not blueberry mead. It's honey varietal from blueberry flowers.
Okay.
And, like, actually, my wife works as hospital office manager for a vet clinic. One of the doctors that she works with swears up and down, one of the best meats I've ever made, the best meat I've ever made, probably, is a blueberry varietal honey that I made with some kvike yeast, and we'll end up talking about that later in this episode. So, love the blueberry varietal. It's a nice honey to play with. Generally not as pricey as Tupelo or Meadow Foam or some of those like $20 a pound set you back, kick in the teeth meads, honeys, but it's still a nice one to play with. Nice fruity notes to it. So
it's very pleasant.
Gonna get a taste of this now. I've been talking too much.
Well, I left without you on that one. but this is a very smooth meat. It has the brandy bite at the top of the mouth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's very not overpowering at all. Even with the bite above, the meat below is still very present.
Mm-hmm. This is going to sound weird to say it like this, but I feel like this one has the, if I'm just drinking like straight brandy on the rocks, which once in a while I'll do that, especially like not so much on the rocks, but sometimes like a hot toddy with brandy is one of my favorite. Hey, I have a sore throat and it's bedtime kind of a drinks in the winter time. This has like the feel and the structure of brandy, but like everything on the inside of it
is the mead.
Is mead.
Yeah, I see where you're coming around that. I'll be honest, I don't put ice in my alcohol because I don't need, ice water down my alcohol. It's God intended.
Well, no. I've heard interviews with a number of like distillers out in Scotland that, they ask about how people take their scotch, right? And more than once they've commented something to the effect of, why the fuck would you drink this neat? It's so fucking harsh. You need to put a little ice in there, or at least a few drops of water to open it up.
I think they need to go to church more.
Different strokes for different folks, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It's however you want to handle it.
All right.
But before we get into those topics, let's, of course, thank our listeners, you guys tuning in, listening in, reaching out. The love we're feeling from you guys is phenomenal. We appreciate it so much.
And yeah, we really, yeah.
Not only that, we also need to thank our sponsors, Box and Barleycorn. Jake the Grew over there are fantastic purveyors of all of your homebrew equipment needs, ingredient needs, everything you could possibly look, whether it's fermenters or, grain for making a nice bracket or, cheese making or kombucha making supplies. You can reach out to them. They have all kinds of stuff there. And you can check our link to a direct link to their show in the show notes. Use our discount code MHP10 and get
10% discount on whatever you're ordering from them. And that way you can get you started on your next batch of great alcohol, cheese, or whatever you're making.
Right. And, never hurts to let them know that, you heard the podcast and we're sending them your way.
Yeah. We would greatly appreciate that, honestly, because, one thing I never would be is on Jake's bad side. I don't think it's going to happen, but nonetheless.
Now he's a little too kind for that. So let's get rolling.
Yeah. No. So deep dive. First, I want to go over is methods of sanitation. I mean, we chemically sanitize.
Right.
We use star sand or the metabisulfite and sodium metabisulfite and things like that. And those are phenomenal. They work great. But that's not. First of all, I had a question come up. Can you use heat? This is a friend of mine actually talked to me directly and says, can't I just make it hot? And I said, yeah, kind of.
So let's, hey, before we get down this sanitizing road, sanitizing is what we want to, is what we're aiming for here. There are other terms that we want to kind of, I would like to just to take a moment to unpack. Sanitizing is one possibility. Pasteurizing is another possibility. And sterilization is a third. What do those all mean? What is the difference? A pasteurization is kind of the one that I'm a little unclear on per se. I only hear about this in a homebrew context from as an alternative to using the sodium metabisulfite, I'm sorry, not sodium, the potassium metabisulfite and potassium sorbates to
kill off the yeast.
Right. I've heard a number of people say that I will pasteurize my mead by putting it in a hot water bath at 140 degrees or 160 degrees for something like an hour, or, you know, 2 hours or something like that. And there are a number of different ways to do that. There is a chart available from the USDA on like the required amount of time and temperature for sterilizing milk. And I know a number of people have used that as a kind of a rough guideline, because if milk is, you know, a worst case scenario, wine or meat has got to be easier, right?
Yeah.
There are some problems with pasteurization in that regard, and we can get into that later. But yes, that will do an effective job of killing the yeast. That can also actually kind of cook your flavors.
Yeah.
If you're using, especially if you're doing a fruit mead, you're going to end up with more of a jammy flavor than a fresh fruit flavor.
And also, we talked about in the last episode, you know, keeping your mead, or episode two ago, when you're storing it, you don't want to have hot or wild temperature fluctuations. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing it with your at this point?
Right. The other thing to consider is, especially like we are talking about in terms of packaging things, glass is generally the preferred vessel for long-term packaging, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're putting it in either beer bottles or wine bottles, whatever. Glass doesn't do well with like going too hot and then cold. It will
Shatter.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if anybody's seen where people had the bright idea of pouring hot water on their windshield to de-ice it in the winter, and they lose a windshield doing that.
Why are you doing this with your mead inside? Come on. You know, let's use technology to our advantage here. We don't have to go basics.
So, yeah, if you're going to get very, very hot with your glass, you need to get cool again very, very
slowly.
Very slowly. So, yes, I've heard of a number of people for going back to the sanitization route of just sticking all of their glass bottles in the oven at some odd temperature for an hour or two. The thing you got to understand, though, is if you're going to do that, you basically need to turn off your oven and let it cool naturally for something like 12 hours, just so that it cools as slow as you can manage. Otherwise, your glass is now more fragile than it was before.
Yeah. And that's, and you know, I don't know about you. I've broken a bottle or two. I don't want to do that. And God forbid you grab a hot bottle.
Right. Bottles are a pain in the butt to clean up, even in the best of circumstances. In the worst of circumstances, they're even more of a pain in the butt. You end up with little micro cuts on your hands and fingers, and no one wants to deal with that. So, yeah, there are a very small number of things you can use heat to sanitize. You could use that on metal objects, for example, as long as they're clean beforehand. You don't want any kind of remaining like organics or biofilms or anything like that. Like you can't just like pull your stir spoon from one batch, toss it in the oven, and then use it on the next batch. You're going to get baked on crud from that first batch on there. That's,
and honestly,
that should be obvious.
The only times you should ever heat sterilize anything is if it's metal or silicon.
Right.
They can handle the heat.
And silicon only to a certain point. You can't go above about 4, depending on the type of silicon, 410 to 450 without it starting to lose some of its structural integrity. So, yeah, you got to be careful with these. The way to go are the sanitizing chemicals that we've talked about a time or two, and we're going to get much deeper in here before. Now, The last term that I wanted to unpack, let me cycle back to that, is sterilization. What's the difference between sanitized and sterilized?
Sanitized is nearly germ-free, and sterilized is completely germ-free.
Essentially, yes, exactly. Those are that's exactly the term. I think the complete sterilization is complete sterilization. Everything dead. There is nothing. Sanitization, what we are going for, which is much easier to achieve in a, especially in a home kitchen or like room environment, is down to like 0.001 percent of microorganisms are dead.
Yeah, and that's if what we're doing, that's more than sufficient. You're pushing the bounds of what you need to do. Anything after that?
Really, the purpose of this is to get rid of almost everything, and then you're putting a massive population of yeast cells into it to make the stuff you want. So they can outcompete that little, thousandth of a percent that is left.
Yeah, I mean, once the yeast is the dominant one in your batch, nothing else is going to win. It will take care of virtually anything else that's going to come across.
Right, at least until it starts going dormant, and then you risk secondary infections like Acinetobacter. And at that point, that's an entirely different thing to talk about.
Yeah,
So,
we're talking about just basic sterilization right now.
sanitization.
Sanitization, yeah. And again, the sanitation methods we like is the ones that are food safe, not bleach, and easy to use, like Star Sand. We both use Star Sand pretty religiously.
StarSat, I think, is the preference for a number of reasons. It's so easy to use. It's food safe. It stores nicely, so you don't have to make up a new batch every time you use it.
It's new. It's no rinse.
Right.
You put it
It's.
on, you use it. I've actually tasted Star Sand directly, undiluted. It's horribly sour and acrid.
Well, it shouldn't
Diluted, it's
be.
just sour.
And even then, if you have a little bit of the foam left over in your batch and it gets mixed in, it's not going to affect the flavor to
It's really not
any
going to hurt
significant
anything.
effect. No.
I have literally sprayed the container, the bucket I'm going to rack into, and used it immediately, dumped out the excess, used it immediately, hasn't dried anything. Nobody's ever noticed.
Ease of use of it alone makes it worth doing,
Yeah.
worth the process.
The other one that Jeff has used is sodium metabisulfite when it's the gas.
Right.
Now, the gas is going to get everywhere there is in that container.
So the important thing, if you're going to take this, to my understanding, the reason this is still preferred as a method is because it is dirt cheap. You're going to spend less than a dollar to get a gallon's worth of the sodium metabisulfite, and it does not last nearly as long as a gallon of sulfite when mixed. But if you need to sanitize and you're going to be doing like three or four batches, you can make that dollar stretch for quite a while for the day. The thing about this is that it stinks because it is letting off a lot of sulfur gas. That sulfur gas is the effective thing that kills things. You pour that into a bucket, put everything you need into it, and then close the lid. The gas trapped in there is the part that does the work. That said, what you don't want to do, you absolutely do not want to do if you're going to use it, is mix it up in a bottle or a jug, open it, and to make sure that it's active, lean in and smell
Take
from
whiffs.
the no, don't do that. You're going to burn every
You're curling your own nose hair. It's not going to be
any nerve cell in your nose is going to be like, ah,
pretty.
I know. What you want to do is hold it out probably like a solid 6 to 8 inches in front of you at most, and
At
kind of
least.
waft it
Yeah.
towards your nose.
If you can smell that again, this is why I use Star Sand. I'm not worried about it.
Right. Star sand has like no smell
Yeah.
whatsoever. It's a fairly neutral for an acid-based solution, fairly neutral taste. The other big one that I would throw out here, iodopor. It's an iodine base instead of an acid base.
Yeah.
I would put that in almost as easy to use as star sand, almost as preferable as star sand, but it's iodine-y, so it has a dark color to it, and it's
Personally, I don't like the look of iodine, so I will not be using it.
fair. But that's another option in there. I think it's nearly as easy to use and nearly as nice as star sand. So.
So yeah. So anyway, so here we go with that. Now, I don't know a lot of ways I can tell you to sanitize everything, but to tell you to sanitize everything when you use it.
Right.
Whatever comes in contact with your meat is what is coming in contact with your meat, and therefore it should be clean. At least to the reasonable sanitization point that we've just mentioned. I, you know, just in the, when I, the last time I was bottling, I bottled four different kinds, four or five different kinds, and I went through 1.5 gallons of sanitizer because I just didn't stop using it. And I keep, and I've made 4 more gallons since then, just so I have it at hand. And my Star Sand, it's like 6 milliliters per gallon of distilled water.
Right.
Just not much. And you put it in, you let it alone, and you move on. So that's as much as I can tell you about sanitation. I mean, if you want to get into the actual science of it, I mean, Jeff can probably tell you more about it, but it's not really that important, in my opinion.
Not much more, to be honest. I'm microbiology was never my particular strong suit.
So the next one we're going, and we touched on it lightly at one point. When storing meads, you do not want to put it in the boiler room or in around a heat source or put it around things that the temperature shifts a lot. So we're going to go into how temperature affects yeast, both in the fermentation process and mead as a general rule.
Right.
First of all, how temperature affects yeast. As I understand, the warmer, quote unquote, within parameters it gets, the faster the mead operates.
So when you buy a strain of yeast from your homebrew store, generally speaking, you can look up white papers on that yeast, and that'll tell you an optimum temperature range, right? It'll say, hey, 71B operates best between like 65 and
60.
72. I don't.
I thought it was 68, but it could be in the 70s.
You probably looked at it much more recently than I am. I'm basically like spitballing stuff off the top of my head.
And I could
And
be mixing up my meats too, so but
right.
it's in the 60, six, the mid low 60 to low 70 range
Right.
at worst.
The white papers give you this range because this is the optimum range for fermenting with that particular yeast's characteristic fermentation qualities. That does not mean it won't ferment at higher temperature. It
Go
doesn't.
lower.
Yeah, exactly. It will ferment in a wide range. Like we talked about before, you can freeze mead and or you freeze your must. You won't kill all that yeast. Some of it will still be hanging out in the ice, living.
And once it thaws out, it'll just start up again.
It's
As
going to take
long as there's
some,
sugar,
right?
it's going to do its job.
It's going to take some while to populate again and get back to the levels where you're going to notice anything, but it will keep going. That said, we're talking about temperature, and when you go higher than that range, generally what you're going to see is more activity. But not only that, you can throw some odd flavors and things like that. That's where you get esters and off flavors, phenols, things like that. So you can also find that the nutrient consumption of these yeasts gets exponential in nature. So you're not feeding them. I have a formula that I like to use. I think it's version 2 of Sergio Metella's formula, and I use it with the Fermade K instead of O. But that optimum nutrient level is 2 or 3 times that number instead of that number or 0.7 of that number, depending on your yeast strain when you go into high temperatures. For whatever reason, they just need a lot more of
And don't forget, your yeast is going to multiply until it runs out of things to eat. So it's
It's
going to keep going faster and faster until it runs out of sugar.
And right at these higher temperatures, it's going to throw a lot more unpredictable stuff, weird smells. This is where you get things like I'm losing the term for it in off the top of my head. It is the same thing, believe it or not, that movie theaters use to flavor the butter oil in their
Okay, I don't know
popcorn.
what that is, but hydroxy something, I think.
Diacetyl.
Yeah, there it is.
Diacetyl. Yes, you'll get weird things like that thrown at these higher temperatures and things like that too. There are, however, some strains that handle high temperatures a lot better. I've talked about these guys before, the Kveik strains. This is like a Norwegian farmhouse strain that where literally it's like these guys took Saccharomyces yeast and built an entirely different domesticated strain of it over a few centuries, and just they shared it amongst each other, but never like really left the outside world. And it's just a wild thing now.
But okay, let's go. What are your favorite yeasts to work with?
What am I making?
For mead, let's start with, you're making, let's traditional or for mead.
So to make a traditional, this is again, well, okay, what kind of honey? There are so many different factors here that kind of make this a complicated thing.
Let's keep it basic for the people listening right
Right.
now, the people just starting. For just let's try a solid mixed,
Right. So as far as just making a basic mead, a basic yeast to use. I really like 71B and I like K1V 1116.
Now, I will say 71B, I looked this up. 71B has a tolerance level of 14% alcohol.
Right.
Anything past that is struggling to keep up or can't.
Well, these are general terms. You can exceed these tolerances sometimes, sometimes not. And it really depends on the health of the yeast, the ferment, and things like that.
And this is all then the 71B is also generally considered the best yeast to use for making mead as a general broad rule.
Yes, it's a workhorse. It's a reliable workhorse. A number of different mead yeasts that I tried starting out were prone to things like stalling, which is just a pain in the butt, and I didn't like dealing with. Consistently, I know I can put 71B into something. I can feed it right, keep it at a decent room temperature, as long as it doesn't get like too hot or, ridiculously garage in the winter cold. It's going to do its thing. It's going to take that 14%, and it's going to, leave me with something nice.
And according to what I've learned online from this is it's good for a late harvest wine or fresh or fruity red rosé wine.
Right. So 71B is a red wine yeast. It has been selected to throw like light phenols and esters that are complementary to red fruit.
So the like the blackberry or the cherry or
Right.
it works great with those.
It's a great choice for those. It's also just a nice choice for a traditional because it just ferments clean-ish. Again, a little fruity ester never really hurt in a traditional. And it's a workhorse that works reliably. It doesn't take a lot of nutrient to use. Yeah, there's a lot of good things to be said for it.
Yeah. Okay. Now we last well, a little while back we were doing a beer run that you're about to finish up, and or you're finished up, and what kind of yeast would you use for that? I mean, and what would the differences be between like 71B and a beer yeast?
Sure. So there are a couple different, when we're talking about beer yeast, what are we trying to accomplish? Are we using a beer yeast in a mead to make a mead? Or are we making a braggot, which is a mead beer hybrid kind of thing? If you're just using a mead, I'm sorry, if you're just using a beer yeast to make a mead, a couple of my favorite strains are Fermentis, US05, and SO4. And it really depends again on what I'm looking for. US05, both of these guys have a tolerance of about 10%. So neither of these are going to be high ABV kind of meads. But sometimes you don't need a high ABV mead.
If you make an 8%, you're going to have a solid meat.
Right.
Don't think otherwise. Even if you have less than that, you're still. It's not about the alcohol; it's about the flavor. It's a solid, good tasting meat.
So,
Very few people care about how much alcohol is involved.
right. US05 is isolated from, they call it like a West Coast strain. So think like Sierra Nevada or the Rogue Brewing Company. These guys out of the West Coast that have the kind of hoppy West Coast IPAs. Their yeast profile, though, super clean. If you just want a clean ferment where the yeast did its thing and didn't leave much of anything else there, US05 is great for that. SO4, on the other hand, is actually that's an isolate from British ale, I believe. And so it's roughly analogous to, like, you could also use, for example, Nottingham from Lallemand, same guys that bring you the Laubin yeast. That gives you a little bit more of those, like, fruity ester kind of combinations. And I find it, yeah, it's nice for anything that has a little bit more of an earthy note to it. And as far as the honey goes, I like that a lot in cider and sizers. And what else have I put that in? A couple, like, braggots that are trying to emphasize more of the malty feel of the malt character. That plays nicely and brings out some of that kind of sweetness to
Yeah.
it. If I'm trying to make a braggot, and I'm trying to, like, there are a couple different approaches here, but if you're making a braggot and you're trying to make a beer style with honey or a super power beer style, just use the strain of yeast appropriate to that style. Because as much as there are, like, you can go to the homebrew store and there's a little tray in front of you with like 8 to 10 wine yeasts.
Yeah.
Ask them how many beer yeasts they have, because I'm willing to bet, like, I know once Jake took over, he shifted from more like Y yeast or Imperial to Omega at Bacchus, which I think was a good move. I like Omega's work a lot. That's my opinion. That's my subjective taste, but he happens to agree with me, so I don't think we're wrong.
No, okay.
Anyway, but yeah, no.
I'll be honest. I don't have an opinion. As long as I have a solid Jesus doing what I want to do,
right?
My conversation is done.
Omega has something like 50 different yeasts of different strains. Some of them are new stuff that they've hybridized and theolized and things like that. Some of them are very traditional, like they have four or five kvikes now that they have with different qualities to them. They have Belgians, they have Germans, they have you know, the West Coast and East Coast and all kinds of stuff. It's great.
Yep. Well, another one I use is like a D47.
Yes.
It's for lighter. Mm-hmm. I will generally use it for just a straight traditional or a Chardonnay, and I made a couple of those.
Right. D47 is one that I came up on. That's the first one I used, and I used it for quite a while for a lot of my stuff. It is not quite as reliable as 71B, in my opinion, but it's still...
It does have a slightly higher tolerance. It's at a 15% mm-hmm. tolerance.
It's still relatively low in nutrient need. I think it's a great, solid choice. It's just not always to my preference.
And the problem that I have with
D47,
I'm sorry.
Yep.
Dyslexic moment, I apologize, is that it has a much narrower band of optimal range.
Right.
Like 62 to 68.
Right. Yeah, the 68 high end, I think, is why I shifted more towards 71B. That kind of, having it in a cold closet or a basement was not always a possibility for me, especially yeah. when I was first starting out and I was in a third floor apartment.
Yeah, that was, I mean, you know, fine, you know, there is yeast out there. They're Jeff's told me some incredibly heat temperature tolerant yeasts, mm-hmm. both high and low. So there's something out there that will do what you need.
Right. These kvike yeast that I keep talking about, again, it's an ale yeast, but the thing is, they throw all kinds of different esters and things like that. And
okay, describe what an ester is, because that could be problematic for some people who don't sure. know.
So an ester is, it's kind of a byproduct of fermentation, but it's a flavor or... sometimes a scent molecule that comes along with it, if we want to conceptualize this. And usually you perceive those as a fruity flavor or a chemically flavor or something like that. And the ones we want to encourage, the ones we like, the ones we select yeast for, they are generally fruity. They're generally fruity or malty or sweet kind of stuff. Sometimes it's a kind of, you don't really know, you wouldn't put a specific fruit on it, but calling it red fruit makes sense.
Yeah.
Kind of. In some cases, like these kike guys, you get a much narrower level. Like this, one of my favorites is the Voss kike from Omega, which for whatever reason, smells and tastes like fresh oranges.
Nice.
To the point where, at one point, just as a whiff, I made a braggot with Pilsner grain, and I forget what kind of honey, but it was a kind of a light honey.
Okay.
And fermented it at like 90 degrees with Voskvike.
That's high.
Yes, very high. And you know what? I sent that in randomly to a contest to be judged. And the judge came back and said, you didn't declare that there were oranges in here, and there are clearly oranges in here. I'm counting you off for this.
There were no oranges in there.
There were no oranges in there. I also, because I declared that there were Pilsner grains, I got checked points off for not making a Pilsner mead. It was just a malt and honey thing. I wasn't trying to get, like, Pilsner style, but...
Pretty tight on those judges there.
You know, people have their preconceived notions, and judging is an objective, I'm sorry, is a subjective process, not an objective process. So much as we would love to be objective, that's...
That doesn't always happen.
It's filtered through a human's experience. Yeah. So right. It is what it is.
Now, the other one I had listed here that I want to talk about was EC1118.
EC1118 is... So EC1118 and K1V116 are both champagne yeasts. EC1118 is kind of the favorite because it has a high alcohol tolerance and it has a relatively clean flavor profile from what I remember. I honestly don't use it much. I see.
It also has an incredibly high tolerance of 18%.
Yes. Yes, it will put out the alcohol. I'm not particularly fond of it. I've seen it used a lot. Maybe I think it's just overused or overhyped. But when it comes to making something on the higher ABV scale, I tend to go for the K1V116. I like the ester profile of it, especially if I'm making something fruity or with apples, especially. Apples and that 116 play so nice together, but it plays pretty well with other kind of light fruits as well.
Okay. Now, some things I haven't tried yet that I have plans in my future for. I wanted to make a hard seltzer at one time. I haven't taken it off my list. It's way back in on the list.
Why make a hard seltzer when you can make a light mead?
Yeah, but the one you use for that is called Popper. It's designed for hard seltzer, the Popper mead. And another one I was looking at for a dry wine and has tolerance of 15%. It's called the Purple. It's a purple yeast mead.
So I've heard of purple, and I actually have a packet of purple that I bought at some point for the purposes of trying and just never got around to it yet.
I had one long enough that it expired, and I just kind of cried, threw it away. So,
Such is the nature of, having a bunch of stuff and having ideas and plans.
but the one I have highest on my list that I want to do soonest is I want to use QA23 because it in a tropical fruit mead because it throws off tropical fruit esters.
Yes.
And I, just having the fragrance and the taste coming off the yeast as well as the fruit is just I want a mar I want Hawaii in my mouth. So, that's what I'm going for there.
I have some QA23 that I've been meaning to use. I've used it just a little bit. I think I've done one or two batches with it
I've got two packets at home.
and was reasonably pleased with the results. I need to do more with it because I've heard, like you, a lot of good things about it, right? And I know I probably have at least 20, if not 30 pounds of Sean Harris's Hawaiian honeys in various
I've got
varietals.
some. Actually, I've got a couple packs of his Boar's Blood Punch mix, which I'm is coming up on the next round of stuff I'm making. I'm going to be making that.
Nice.
I'm going to re-ferment. I'm going to rehydrate it and stick it in secondary for my for a tradition I'm going to make for it.
But yeah, no, with these honeys of tropical fruit varietals, that sounds right. You
Yeah.
said a QA23 on.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that, like, it's not low on my list. It's not the tippy top of my list. It's probably a
It's in the upper quarter.
yeah, it's three quarters of the way up there. I just haven't gotten around to it yet because I'm a busy guy.
I mean, I don't know how many buckets you have. I like 7 8 7 gallon buckets. I've got five 2 gallon buckets. I've got set 6 or 7 1 gallon buckets and 3 3 gallon buckets.
I try to keep things light. I have a 7 gallon bucket, I have a 7 gallon stainless steel fermenter, and I have 2 3 gallon big mouth bubblers. And
And I didn't even count my carboys.
honestly, like, if I get more than three or four batches deep, I lose track of everything and just, yeah, I can't.
Notes. I just take notes.
Notes are great, but I forget to do stuff, and it's this is not my job. If I could just run a brewery all day, I'd probably have a lot better handle on this because I would just go through every day and check this and check this and check
Life
this.
goals. I like
Well,
that.
if I could just do that with all the paperwork, without all the paperwork and paying taxes and government in inspections and things like that, I'd probably already be doing that.
Yeah, life goals. Anyway, so that I wanted to go into now what happens when you get too much sugar in your mead? What happens with the yeast?
So,
We touched on with the tolerance levels, but
yes. So there are a few different ways this can happen. Obviously, if you've got just a little too much sugar, what you're going to end up with, the yeast is going to reach its stated alcohol tolerance, and then it will maybe, if you've fed it right and it's in a happy condition and it's got a little extra, it might go another percentage point or two higher. I wouldn't expect more than two at the very best.
okay.
So a K1V, for example, might go all the way to 20. D47 might go to 16 or 17.
Okay.
Wouldn't expect any higher than that. Anything else, any other sugar in there, is just going to sit as residual sugar. However, if you go way over the top, there's a thing called osmotic pressure that's going to basically understand that sugar, whether it's in honey or it's granulated or it's mixed in your water, is hydrophilic. It wants water pulled into it. And that's why honey can last basically indefinitely in nature, because a single cell organism, whether it's a mold or a bacteria or a yeast, will come in contact with that honey. And that honey, being hydrophilic, will pull water out of that cell, kill it. That keeps the yeast that's basically everywhere around us all over, kind of floating through the air at all times from fermenting honey by itself. It just can't. If you have too much sugar, honey, whatever, in a mead must, and you try to put yeast into it, what you're going to get is a stout. The yeast kind of goes, I can't. It's too hard.
I can't move.
I just don't want to.
Oh,
And it's not necessarily going to kill the yeast, but you're not going to know anything about whether or not it's alive or dead for any time because it's just not going to do anything. It can't. It's just too hard. Now, granted, it takes a lot to do that. We're talking like something in the neighborhood of like 1170 or 1200-ish for a starting gravity to get to that point. Some yeasts have a higher like tolerance to that than others too. Some of them will kind of start to flake out around like 1140, for example. I tend not to go that high anyway, but
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. As I was telling you earlier, off mic, my son started his first mead experiment. He wanted to make a sassafras mead. My son has the taste buds of a very old man. He likes sassafras, root beer, and black licorice.
I don't like black licorice,
Well,
but
he
otherwise,
does.
shush.
He does. He wants the actual black licorice candy, not the not for sugar. But nonetheless, he decided when his first try was going to be for sassafras mead. Now, because my son loves random, he stuck a bunch of honey in a gallon jar, almost 4 pounds. It had 18.7 something percent potential alcohol volume. I don't have a yeast in my box that's gonna is that high. So I was using the 71. And it burbled away for a couple of weeks very happily. We recently killed the yeast. I haven't yet taken a chance to measure it again. I measured it almost towards the point. Last time I measured it, it started out, I don't remember, I have to look at my notes to see what high it was, but it ended up on 1040 right range. That's where it ended up.
Gravity range is the one you want to use. I would not look at your potential alcohol by volume on that hydrometer. To be honest,
I was just using the map on
it's
the computer from there.
yeah. If the I would think that's like the least useful of those scales, but no. If you've got 1040, that's potentially pretty sweet as of a final gravity. You said it was it D47 or 71?
71.
71. Okay, so I mean, did he feed it with nutrient and whatnot?
Yo, you put go for a minute.
How much?
About a teaspoon.
Okay.
Remember, it's a 1 gallon batch. It's not huge.
So there are different schools of thought here with nutrient, and the problem I think with hey, I'm just going to put in a volume of honey and not measure the gravity is how do you know how much nutrient to put in too? Like I was just saying a little while ago, I have a formula that I've been using for years that I like and has been working for me nicely, so I just do that and I use that to get a weight in grams of how much nutrient I put in.
Well, that's why I took the measurements, and this was an agreement with him and me. I simply won't tell him what they are. I can make a recommendation, but this is his meat, his choice. And we have not. It's ready to be racked and filtered and all that, and see what we can do from there. But I haven't put the sassafras root in it yet. It's going to be secondary.
Okay, well, that's common for, herbs and spices and foods.
But nonetheless, but here we go. But he put an atrocious amount of honey in that thing.
Yes, that's kind of a lot. And like I've mentioned before, my general process or my preferential process for if I'm going to make a sweet mead is I add enough honey into primary to make the amount of alcohol that I want. I let it reach that point, stabilize, and then I make that sweet. I don't rely on
And that's
residual
more
sugar.
what I try to do.
Right. Because, I mean, if we do, let's say we put 3.5 pounds of honey into a batch in the winter and we pour D47 in there, and then we do the same thing in 4 months later in the middle of spring, you're going to get different results.
Very.
So, no, to my way of thinking, the way to mitigate that is to handle each piece separately and get each piece to the level you want. So get the alcohol volume and then get the sweetness to where you want it.
I didn't say he did it the way we do it,
No, I'm
but I'm just
saying,
saying this way he wanted to do it, and I'm letting him do it.
right. There is nothing. I mean, I would rather you teach him the right way to do it in the first place, but
If he would learn, I would teach.
children are willful, and that is their way.
Yes. And but I also want to say that even he is willing to accept a failure.
Sure.
I mean, he knows that's how you. But now the next logical question I want to bring up after what happens if you have too much sugaring, and yet obviously that's a lot more than I thought, even I thought it was.
Right.
But okay, what do you do when it run, what does yeast actively do? And I know the answer to this, I believe, when it runs out of yeast. Now, when
What
I
was that,
first thought
sugar?
about when it runs out of sugar, and my thought was, at my early days, I'd say it died. It did not die. It went dormant.
Right. It gets sleepy.
They get sleepy.
Depending on the type of yeast, this is another thing that yeasts are selected for is flocculation, meaning as they go into a dormant state, they have the ability. Some yeasts do this very much, some yeasts do this very little, but they will kind of clump together and just kind of, they don't die, but they do get sleepy, for lack of a better
The
name.
hibernate.
Right. They have nothing to eat, they have nothing to do, so they are functionally inactive. Yeah. And they'll clump together sometimes. As they clump together, the balance of those yeast in liquid becomes heavier, and so they sink. And some yeasts are high flocculators. They will basically make a nice compact yeast cake on the bottom of a fermenter and leave a fairly clear liquid in the end.
That'd be kind of cool to
Some
see.
are low to mid flocculators. You get something pretty hazy until you take steps to correct it, whether that's like super clear or a cold crash or filtering or whatever. And I wouldn't recommend filtering anything that isn't already pretty clear, because that's a good way to clog
Go
your
through a
gullets.
lot of filters. I have done that not too terribly long ago. I went through three filters in first level filtering.
Yeah, that's
And that was only a 3 gallon batch.
you do that
Turned out.
once, you learn your lesson.
Yeah. And I honestly honest I did rack it, but I should have racked it two or three more times.
Yeah, no, it's
Or second and third time.
one pack of Super Clear is a lot cheaper than or whatever the hell they're calling it. Is it Super
Duo
Clear?
Fine?
Dual Fine is what they're calling it
Duo
now.
Fine.
Yes,
I like that stuff.
it's one pack of that is a lot cheaper than a pack of filters. And if you're going through two or three, then
Why not
no,
Duo
no.
Fine?
Right.
All right, well, that was what I wanted to go over. If there's any questions you guys have about a particular issue you would like to use or anything like that, by all means, please let us know. And we'll get you every information we can.
Right. Moreover, topic suggestions,
Topic suggestions are
like
even better. We want to know what you want to hear about.
comments, criticism. You know, this is a conversation between me and my friend here, but this is also a wider conversation between us and you guys too. So let us know what you want to hear about, what you want to talk about. If you think we're being stupid and we have made major errors in our life choices and things like that,
Point it out.
I mean, sure, we're going to disagree with you, but you can tell us.
It's just, it's not my first time. Made a lot of mistakes. But anyway, so Jeff, I'll talk to you next time.
Yep.
Thank you for joining. Take care.
Night, everybody. Have a good one.